Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm excited to be back with you here after a few weeks off where I was traveling and we had some breaks in our schedule. But we're back and I'm excited to get into tonight's topics. But before we can do anything like that, we have to jump in and invite our co-host, Sam Bradley, in. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie, how are things on the East Coast?
They're all right. It's March, so it's chilly one day, warm the next, and we're used to that. So might explain the cold I have. So
yeah, definitely. Well, we got Dr. Joe with us. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys, how are you?
How are things in Memphis?
Well, very nice today, actually. It's been a really, really nice day, and I have to introduce a new member of the herd here.
Oh, too bad you out there can't see the cutest dog in the world.
Oh, he's pretty cute. We're just babysitting for a while, but he's pretty cute. He is a Teddy Roosevelt Terrier. I've never even heard of one.
Never even heard of that. Kyle Nelson, have you ever heard of that?
Can't say that I have until just now.
He barks loudly and chases a big stick. So
I knew somebody would say that. All righty. Well, you know, we're going to talk about training tonight, and we're going to start with Kyle as far as training because he does a lot of that. And you were just telling us you were doing some ICS training. You want to explain that to some of the people that may not know what it is?
Absolutely, Sam. So I'm really fortunate here to be part of a couple of Type 3 incident management teams in Colorado, one at the county level where I work and another in the northwest region of the state. And on those teams, I fill the positions of planning section chief and situation unit leader. So I'm very fortunate that I was able to find some position-specific training down here with our friends in Florida, and I'm actually down here currently taking a situation unit leader and planning section chief class to kind of bolster my skills, round out a few things, do some networking, and overall just learn a lot more about the duties of the position and some of the nuances, and also a little bit of how Florida does incident management, because fun fact, the state of Colorado is often one of the first requests for assistance to send incident management teams down to the state of Florida when they're impacted by tropical systems. So it's always good to know and meet some of the folks right before you show up on their doorstep and in their communities to help support them following disasters. So it's been a couple fun weeks of learning. Looking forward to getting back to the mountains, though. But hey, sunshine is always good.
Hey, Kyle, would you spend a little bit of time explaining to our audience sort of what the planning section chief and the situation unit leader actually do?
Absolutely, Joe. I knew you wouldn't let me get away with that one. So for those that aren't aware, in the sort of the structure of in incident management organization, one of the key positions is a planning section chief. And what that involves is essentially planning for the next operational period, or as think about like the initial response to some incident or event, like a tornado, for example, right? Get a team in there to not just gather who's all on scene, what paperwork and documentation has been generated, and you know who's all involved, but what is happening? What's the situation sort of holistically within the incident, right? What are we dealing with? What areas are impacted and all that, like the extent of the thing. And then the planning section chief is looking at, I'm collecting this documentation, the incident status and all that. I'm projecting how that may evolve forward in time, what threats or hazards can present themselves that maybe other teams haven't thought of. So working with our technical specialists like the National Weather Service and others based on the hazards du jour you're presented with, and then ultimately compiling that along with a list of objectives and projections and things and plans for the next day or the next operational period, so that when the next round of folks comes in to relieve those that have been in the field, they have a good good idea of what their marching orders are, clear roles and responsibilities, and the all ever important maps of the incident and an idea of what they might be getting themselves into. So that's sort of the planning section chief role. And one of the roles within that that I really love is the situation unit leader, which think about this as like a, if you will, like a dispatcher on steroids. So right, dispatch, 911 dispatch, they've got their fingers in everything. They know what's going on, who's involved, who's coming to play, who's doing what. And now think about that, but for that specific incident that you're working and getting your brain around that so that when your incident commander, your operations folks, your public information officers who are sharing information with the public, or anyone else on that team or an agency administrator comes in and says and asks a question about the status of the incident or some part of it, you'd best have the answer for them and be able to communicate it in a way that they can understand it and use it effectively to then share it with others or make good decisions. So those are the two positions that I mainly fill in the essence of the training that I'm taking here this week.
Kyle, what are some of the things that you're most looking forward to learning about in these classes that you're taking down there?
I think for me, the thing that I'm most looking forward to is really sort of getting my head around some of these, you know, some of the challenges that, you know, and finding ways that other folks have addressed some of the challenges that we have, such as like resource tracking, right? Like what are some good systems that folks have used? What have you found to be successful, right? What are the pitfalls that folks have encountered? Learning from the instructors, but also my fellow classmates has been super valuable because, I mean, let's face it, Florida has no shortage of disasters year after year after year, right? They eat, sleep, and breathe the incident command system. And learning from them, hearing from their stories, and really starting to more solidify my knowledge of what do I want to watch out for? What can I learn from others so that I might not repeat those same mistakes? And also sharing my my missteps and things with them. So ultimately, right, we can have those open conversations, move forward together, and foster a really awesome and positive learning environment, sharing tips and tricks along the way, and building professional relationships and friendships that will probably come in very, very handy come hurricane season.
Exactly. Joe, a question for you. How closely aligned is your FEMA IMST, which you're very involved with the level that Kyle's working in for the state of Colorado?
Well, we mirror that exactly. Quite honestly, the incident command system is designed for exactly that. It can be applied at multiple levels by multiple groups. It's flexible and allows you to plug in as needed. So the fact that the local, state, regional, and federal levels all are functioning on the same concept and sort of map of positions and people and tasks allows that entire group to work together seamlessly and plug in as needed. Everybody is already familiar with what the job is and what needs to be done there. So it really enhances the ability to respond.
Excellent. Well, we're going to jump back to you in a minute, Joe, but since we got a weather dude here, the weather squatch. I just had a couple questions on this tornado outbreak we recently had. EF1s, EF3s, the worst damage and three deaths in Ohio. But it had, you know, involved 13 counties in Ohio and Indiana and Kentucky and all over the place. One of the things I noticed in my research was that warm weather seems to have been a factor in why all those tornadoes developed. Would you reflect on that for us?
Sure thing, Sam. And with the, especially as we get into springtime, right, we've got the changing of the seasons and we've got some more dramatic differences that are present with the air masses that are moving across the country. And in this particular case, that's a clash of air masses over the central and Great Lakes part of the United States, ultimately helped to touch off some very devastating supercell thunderstorms, right? Those thunderstorms that have a rotating updraft that had, you know, all the ingredients necessary for tornado formation, right? So they had the vertical wind shear. So we had winds changing speed and direction with height, sort of helping to cause that air and those storms to rotate there on a local level. They had a source of lift, right? Right along, you know, whether it be like a cold front or that lift can come from up higher in the atmosphere as well, helping to cause that air to want to rise. And then the instability, right, that you mentioned, Sam, that warm weather, that warm, moist air near the ground level, right, warm air, like a hot air balloon, it's less dense than the cooler air above it, so it wants to rise. It's an unstable air mass. And so now you take all that with the sufficient moisture in place and combine those in just the right amounts, right? Think of your favorite recipe, right? You can have all the ingredients there, but if they're not present in just the right amounts, the dish doesn't turn out as it as you might hope that it would. And in this particular case, those ingredients did come together, unfortunately, as you said, causing tens of injuries that were reported and those three fatalities that we know of at this point.
In one case, there was a pair of tornadoes that came together and formed a larger one. How often does that happen?
Well, it's a pretty rare event. For that to happen, I mean, sometimes it can be constructive and you have two storms with rotating updrafts that come together and they actually form one stronger storm. Or sometimes they kind of clash and cause that storm, those individual storms to dissipate. So it's there's really no, you know, way to predict that for sure, but it's a rare event and it may look beautiful on radar. It might be visually appealing, but ultimately, right, we're always concerned with the impacts to the infrastructure, the individuals, and the communities in the path of these storms.
Okay, one more question for you. I would assume that your meteorological, say that three times, expertise goes a long way in your ICS world. Is it not?
It absolutely does. And it's funny you mentioned that. I was actually called upon several times in our Situation Unit Leader class to speak about the technical specialists, including the incident meteorologist that a team or that a municipality may interact with, both, say, before an event unfolds like this, during a planned event that they're supporting, or following or during an incident. That happens, right? Weather drives so much of our day-to-day lives. Now think of that as you've got, say, these tornadoes that have occurred, you've got responders out working in the field, right? They are focused on the mission of, right, saving lives, protecting property, and, you know, mitigating larger environmental impacts. But now you've got to have someone taking that step back, like your incident meteorologist, to say, what might be coming next? What weather hazards will impact these responders' ability to stay safe in the field so that they do not become additional injuries or casualties of this event. And that drives a lot of it. Same thing if, say, you have a hazardous materials release, be it large or small, that the wind and all that drives how that chemical or whatever it might be disperses and where it goes. And so weather plays a huge role in the incident management world. And I'm very fortunate that we focused on that so very much.
So, Joe, I'm sure you'd agree with that on the many incidents you've been on. And part of your role is taking care of your team. So when you go into an area that's been devastated, you know, by a tornado or hurricane or whatever, that weather's probably still there, right?
Sometimes it certainly is. And obviously, weather is just one of the many hazards that you have to deal with in a high threat environment like a post-disaster scenario. So the absolute last thing you want to do is have any of the responders get hurt or injured for all the obvious reasons. But in addition to the fact that we're working in an area that's had its infrastructure significantly impacted. The last thing that excuse me, that responders want to do is be a further drain on that infrastructure. So, you know, the need to have a responder have to go to a local medical care facility and tie up those facilities when they're needed for the folks that have been directly impacted is always frustrating, in addition to the fact that obviously it takes that person off the line and they can no longer be a responder. So the weather is probably frequently the most changeable threat that we face on a deployment of any kind.
Joe, yeah, go ahead, Jamie.
No, I was going to say, Joe, can you talk a little bit more about the importance and the way that teams are self-sufficient when they deploy? Because so much of, you know, like you said, so much of the infrastructure when you deploy to a location is non-existent. So you pretty much pack in everything you think you're going to need for your team, right?
Yeah, we absolutely do. We're designed to be completely self-sufficient for a number of days, including food, water, you know, shelter, and the whole nine yards, with the idea that resupply is going to take a while, no matter what the environment that you're in, and that we do not wish to, again, be a drain on local scarce resources. Fuel and food and shelter are all incredibly impacted during these big disasters. And so we want to show up and be able to do our work without negatively impacting the folks that were there to help.
Joe, would it also be a good guess that, you know, because every experience that you've had that we're aware of, because we do report on that when you're out there and when I used to be out there, and everyone seems to be different and have different challenges regardless of what you've done in the past. Would I assume correctly that those translate over to the kind of training you do at Paragon?
Yeah, no question about it. You know, I mean, Kyle touched on many of the important things that the planning section is doing. And I think it's important to understand in a major disaster, everything takes a very long time. You know, transportation is impacted, people are impacted, buildings are destroyed, warehouses are ruined with the equipment that's in them, et cetera. So, you know, the need to plan ahead and get moving on all that sort of stuff is important, that it is initiated as early as you think you are going to need it. So part of much of the training that Paragon does incorporates those concepts in there so that people are thinking about that. And you know, we obviously focus on the medical aspects of all that. So the idea of performing a rescue and extricating someone from a collapsed structure has its own dangers and strategies and expertise associated with it. But once they're out, you know, the nearest trauma center may be 300 miles away. And oh, by the way, there's no helicopters flying right now. So how do you move that patient to higher levels of care? And if you're going to be needing to do that, you have to get that started very early in the process, and there has to be a plan for it. And, you know, you don't just call up the National Guard and say, hey, I need a helicopter. I mean, you get on the list and you wait along with a million other sorties that they're flying and the million other priorities that they have to deal with. So that's why the planning and training is so important.
Well, I know that you guys have been doing a lot of training with the military. So there's another element in what we're talking about tonight, as far as the different types of ISTs that seem to be working under the same platform. What do you got coming up with Paragon?
Well, we'll actually be in Rhode Island in a couple of weeks. That's going to be a fairly straightforward procedural-based lab for the first responders in that area to help them refine and hone their skills and teach them a few new skills. After that, let's see. I think we just did a big lab in the northwestern part of Arkansas and the eastern part of Oklahoma last week, and we're back over in Arkansas again right after Rhode Island. So we got two or three right in a row. After that is probably Las Vegas and then Florida. So we're kind of going all over, plus several military things that are in the pipeline.
Well, it sounds like you're going to spend a lot of time on airplanes, and who knows, maybe you and Kyle will be in Florida at the same time. You never know. You kind of wonder, because even with you and I being on the same incident, like Hurricane Harvey, you know, you kind of assume you might run into somebody, but we did work for different federal agencies, but it would have been kind of a hoot if that had happened, but it never does.
It does happen occasionally. It's just folks are so spread out over those incidents and are tasked with different things. And, you know, sometimes you just never cross paths, even though it's all in the same disaster response. You're covering literally the entire state of Florida. So a lot of ground to cover.
Well, you and Ben Abo managed to get together on one of those incidents. I think it might have been Harvey. But that was pretty cool.
That is correct. So part of my role with the incident support team, which is kind of the command and control structure, is to interface with the individual task forces that are out there. So as I'm out doing my job, part of that job is to connect with the medical teams from each of the individual teams to make sure that they have what they need. They're up to speed. We're all on the same game plan, et cetera. So it's that's kind of part of the job, and so it's a little easier to connect with those guys than it is with folks who may be there from NDMS, for example, just because those entities are not places that we're routinely going to. They're set up, they're functioning, they're doing their thing. We may be sending patients to them, but in a lot of cases, we're way out in the field and may never even see those folks.
Yeah, no, darn it. I was always hoping that would happen. The other thing you do, you go to a lot of high-level meetings with other doctors and you know, different conferences. Have you been to any of those lately?
Gosh, let's see. I guess the last big conference I did was the National Association of EMS Physicians Conference. That was, you know, 6-8 weeks ago. That's a gathering of EMS physicians from around the world, mostly in the U.S., of course. And it's a academic-based conference where we get educated, exposed to what everybody else is doing, sort of the latest science and research opportunities to obviously commingle with our colleagues from around the country and around the world and see some new stuff and learn some new stuff.
Well, that's something I was thinking about when Kyle was talking about his training, because he's a guy that does so much training. But it goes to show you, you know, even the people that do this all the time can always learn something from somebody else, and that things change and protocols change and incidents bring up new stuff that needs to be changed. And so you never quit learning, right?
There's no question about that. Actually, one of the things I really love about doing the training that I do is I get exposed to lots of variations on how to do things from all around the country and all around the world. And it's fantastic to be able to sort of pull best practices out of that. And when folks are having, trouble with something, oftentimes I'm aware of someone else who had that same problem figured out a way to solve it. So a great example has been literally just in the last couple of months or so, I spoke with a fire department in the Dakotas that was really struggling with their ability to get their supraglottic airway to seal very well, and trouble getting high quality end-tidal CO2 readings off of it. And they had struggled with multiple different ways to try to figure out what the problem was. Was it the device, the training, the monitor, you know, what was the deal? And I was able to share with them some experiences I'd had that we had done in one of our cadaveric research sessions, where we figured out the sort of counterintuitive repositioning that you needed to do to make a better seal. And so I passed that on to them, and then heard from them a week later and said, you know, unbelievable, that fixed it. You know, so that's an incredibly satisfying experience, and it's absolutely wonderful to be able to hook folks up with people who have solved a problem, right? No matter what the problem is, somebody someplace has solved it. So I just feel like I connect people together a lot.
Well, that's a good thing. And the information you gave them was clearly valuable. But Kyle, that's kind of the same thing you were saying. You know, sharing experiences and solutions and best practices with your group as well, right?
Definitely. Because we do everything from, you know, the Winter X Games and doing that as our incident management team, overseeing it, all the way to, you know, dignitary visits, mud, flood, wildfire, and a whole slew of things. But right, there's always so much to learn based on the different hazard types, the challenges that are presented, and how hearing folks tell about their challenges, their triumphs, and how they overcame them, as you said, right, super important. And kind of just going back to a quick thing that was mentioned, right, with the integration of the military side of it, in both classes so far here, I've had Coast Guard representation in there, and I am continually blown away at how dialed in the Coast Guard is when it comes to incident management and the incident command system. And, you know, you want to talk about an organization that truly has a handle on it. I learned so much from our Coast Guard participants in the class, and it was really fun. So if, you know, yes, you know, folks might make fun of them, you know, in certain ways and things like that, see a lot of parodies, but I'll tell you what, if, you know, when push comes to shove, if I deploy down here, I'm hoping for a Coast Guard member on my team in the planning section.
Yeah, I can relate to that, because I really learned my ICS working with the Cal Fire, you know, the state fire department in California, when we started working at on a state level, because those people really knew what they're doing. And when you have a big incident like that, you have to have it under control. But I got to say one more thing before I throw it to Jamie. The picture you have up there now is a pretty nice selfie with the sunset in the background, but it makes you look like you have a halo. And there's something interesting about that. I just had to say that. Jamie?
Yeah, Kyle's always got the great pictures on his social media feeds. If people aren't following him, they should. So I'll just leave it at that, and they can track him down when we get to the section at the end of the show. But Joe, you know, sounds like Paragon's pretty busy, but I know there's probably always some room to squeeze some other people in for those that want to get that kind of customizable training experience for their people.
Oh yeah, we always are happy to talk to folks. We do like to customize the product that they're getting so that it suits their needs, and we're always happy to chat with them. I think a lot of the issue with what we do is there are a lot of preconceived notions that people have and assumptions that they make, which are often not correct. And so actually talking about it is very helpful. So we would always encourage folks to reach out to us. They can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group, or always through the Disaster Podcast.
Great, Joe. And Kyle, where can folks find your excellent photography and selfies?
Oh, gosh. Well, Jamie, folks can find those and more on all my social media pages under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. And you can visit my Instagram to check out my skydiving video from the Florida Keys over the weekend.
Excellent. Well, I'll have to do that. Definitely. As soon as we're done this call, I'm going to look that up. Sam, where can folks find you?
I want to be Kyle because he has so much fun. But, oh, that wasn't the question. All of those places, all the social media is under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And in our Facebook community under Disaster Podcast and certainly on disasterpodcast.com. Jamie?
You can find me under the handle Podmedic in most social media locations. So look me up, friend or follow me there. And as always, look us up over at disasterpodcast.com and in our Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And we look forward to bringing folks in and continuing the conversation, as Kyle likes to say. So, Sam, good episode. I really like the talk about incident command system and incident command structure. We don't talk about it probably enough on the show, and for people that are new to it or don't use it quite frequently as they should for major incidents, it's something that we should be practicing more often.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we were able to look at the parallels between what Kyle's doing with the state of California and what Joe does with his federal agency. So that isn't something we'd had the opportunity to do. But my last comment on this particular podcast is never stop learning.